You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 11th of March 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Andrew Tuck. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, following the abduction and deaths of seven foreign workers in Nigeria, we'll take a closer look at a country beset by ethnic, religious and terrorism issues.
However horrible the acts of these groups, we know that they've grown out of a context of extreme poverty and underdevelopment.
And we'll catch up with our Jerusalem correspondent, Joseph Dana, who's at the Herzliya Conference, known as the Davos of Israel. Then we'll head to the Vatican for a preview of one of the world's most curious political rituals.
We've got around 5,000 journalists here from all around the world, all pretty much clear in the knowledge that they are unlikely to get the exclusive on this story. The speculation is enormous and rife.
And our Tokyo bureau chief Fiona Wilson looks at Japan's recovery after the devastation of the triple disaster that hit the country 2 years ago.
Recent photographs of the Fukushima nuclear plant have revealed that it is still piled with debris and tangled metal. Thousands of people are working on its recovery, but it will take decades to decommission the reactors.
All that, plus we have lunch with our New York bureau chief, check in with our foreign editor in Sao Paulo, and head to a food festival in Florence. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. But first, let's catch up on the headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
European Union foreign ministers arrived in Brussels today to discuss the ongoing crisis in Syria, which has killed more than 70,000 people and has displaced more than a million Syrians. The British Foreign Secretary, William Hague, said he would engage with the Russians over the issue later in the week.
I will meet Sergei Lavrov later this week in London to discuss that with the Russians. But in order to push that, in order to promote that, we should also continue to increase our support for the Syrian opposition, the National Coalition, to send a clear message to the regime that we will do that in the absence of a political settlement in Syria and in order to try to save lives.
Italian judges have today ordered checks to be made on the former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi to verify his claim that health problems meant he was unable to attend his trial on charges of paying for sex with a minor. The 76-year-old media billionaire has been in hospital since Friday because of an eye problem that he says has forced him to cancel a number of public appointments. However, prosecutors believe that his stay in hospital may only be a delaying tactic. In the Netherlands, the trial of eight suspected killers of a Dutch volunteer soccer linesman began today in a court in Lelystad. Richard Nieuwenhuizen was attacked on the 2nd of December while officiating an under-17 match between Belton Boys, Almere, and Nieuw Sloten, Amsterdam, and died the following day. Sander Janssen is a lawyer for one of the accused.
It is a start of trial, it's called a pro form start. So what we're talking about now is just further investigation and pretrial detention, that's it. And the case itself will be dealt with probably in May.
Here, disgraced former British Energy Minister Chris Huhne has been jailed for 8 months today for lying to police about a speeding offence in a bizarre tale of adultery and revenge that gripped the British public. Huhne's ex-wife Vicky Price was also jailed for 8 months for her role in that deception. Prior to the scandal, Huhne had been seen as a potential leader of the Liberal Democrats, the junior partners of the Conservatives in Britain's ruling coalition government. Residents of the Falkland Islands queued for the second day of voting today in a sovereignty referendum that seeks to counter Argentina's claim over the British-ruled territory. Diplomatic tension between Britain and Argentina has flared up after more than three decades since they went to war over these South Atlantic islands, and that has unsettled some of the roughly 2,500 islanders. The referendum asked them if they want to stay a British overseas territory. Well, Craig Pace and Ian Strage were in the queue waiting to vote.
I think the world will take notes. I don't think Argentina will take note. I think Argentina's stance on the Falklands will stay the same. But hopefully the world will now listen and know that the people of the Falkland Islands have a voice.
I think it will go a long way to getting a message round the world that we may be a very small community, but we have got a voice. you know, because we're so small, you know, there's so much that's not known about us, and this is a form of education, if you like, for the rest of the world.
And finally, an endless stream of pilgrims arrived at an ancient temple in Kathmandu in Nepal today, joining over 100 naked ascetics who puffed on pipes filled with cannabis. The ancient Shivaratri festival is Nepal's biggest annual religious event, which brings an estimated 1 million devout Hindus flocking to Kathmandu's main temple each year for rituals to cleanse them of sin and earn a place in heaven. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. It's 18:05 here in London, and you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Buenos Aires
to Hong Kong
to Berlin,
to Tel Aviv,
to Toronto,
to Amsterdam,
to Zurich.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
A video has emerged today which purports to show the bodies of seven workers kidnapped in northern Nigeria on February the 16th. The men were from Lebanon, the UK, Greece and Italy and had been working on a construction site. Ansaru, a terror group associated with Al-Qaeda, has claimed responsibility. Is yet another bloody date in Nigeria's recent history of religious and tribal conflict. Why has Nigeria, an oil and resources-rich nation, become a byword not just for violence, but corruption and mismanagement on the grandest scale? Earlier, I spoke with Elizabeth Donnelly, Africa Programme Manager at Chatham House, to get her perspective on Nigeria's woes. Elizabeth, perhaps we could just start with the news today about these killings that seem to have taken place. What do we know about Ansaru?
We don't know actually that much about Ansaru. It's said that it's a splinter group of Boko Haram. It does operate also in the northern part of Nigeria, but in a different region. It seems to be focused mostly around kind of north-central, northwestern part of Nigeria. It is an extremist Islamist organization. It is distinctive, I'd say, from Boko Haram. It seems to be a much smaller operation in terms of Westerners, Western targets. It seems to be a more lethal organization, somewhat more extreme, and potentially more formal links, particularly ideologically, to outside of Nigeria than, say, Boko Haram.
Now, over time, they've done lots of things to try and hold the country together. They moved the capital to Abuja. They've tried to bring the communities together. But do you think that essentially Nigeria is, you know, both tribally, religiously, so divided that it has to be run, you know, in a more federal way, and power will slowly devolve out to those provinces?
Yeah, I think it is a country of such great scale, such great diversity, that the federal model does indeed make sense. And there have been clearly efforts to address this. I think one of the problems, of course, is the question of where does it stop? Everybody can identify themselves as different somehow. And even now, with the constitution review process, one of the items you see, you know, that there's pressure for creation of more states, for example.
And tell me, now Nigeria should be one of the richest countries in the world. It has massive oil reserves, but the majority of its people are living on less than $2 a day. How can that be? Is that just the level of corruption that is embedded within the Nigerian system, do you think?
Yes, corruption remains an enormous problem for Nigeria, but this is also about challenges to do with simply mismanagement, structures, strength of institutions to deal with the resources to manage them effectively.
Now, we're looking across the region, we're seeing countries like Ghana looking at actually at Nigeria and thinking, here's a bad example of what you do when you have oil wealth. And those countries are trying to put in the institutions and trying to run things more effectively. Similarly, do you think Nigeria could look to its neighbours and could look elsewhere to find some path out of this trouble? What would be the two or three key things you think Nigeria should do now if it wants to kind of find a path back to a bit more stability?
Well, one of the crucial things, I think we've seen what's been going on in the north in response to the problems there, has been a very heavy-handed security response, which the federal government expects to address this in the short term. But I'd suggest that this is actually a longer-term problem. And however horrible the acts of these groups, we know that they've grown out of a context of extreme poverty and underdevelopment. So there is a strong argument for something to be done about that. Some people argue for a specific kind of development program or Marshall Plan, they call it, for northern Nigeria. But arguably, lack of opportunity is a problem in other parts of the country as well. I think one of the key things that needs to be delivered is the reform of the power sector. Lack of power in Nigeria creates huge additional costs to economic activity, to producing anything. In terms of an effort to diversify Nigeria's economy, generating and transmitting enough power is really crucial. You do then have the key issues of strengthening institutions. Then one of the other areas, and this is on the federal government's transformation agenda and a number of state government's agendas, is agricultural reform and trying to grow agriculture in Nigeria. It once used to be an exporter of food and is now an importer, and it would like to reverse that. There are definitely some things around there, but I think broadly just economic diversification is important for the entire country. What you've seen in terms of development in the southwest of the country has been made possible because there's a range of economic activity. This is something that needs to happen elsewhere. And then coming back to your earlier point, it's about creating a national identity, I think, national unity. And again, how do you do that?
And finally, could you just tell me, do you think there will be growing support in the north for the likes of Boko Haram? And how wide is that support for these terrorist groups at the moment?
There's no data on this, but from everything I understand, I'd say that support is limited, especially for a group like Ansar, but also for Boko Haram. It does have a membership. It's still not clear how big that membership is, but my understanding is that beyond kind of immediate communities of those members, support is fairly limited. But the problem is that while ordinary citizens might not support these groups, nor do they support the government necessarily because of the heavy-handed way in which this has been dealt with. And a lot of people are being arrested. We've had the Human Rights Watch report that said that people are being just taken from their homes and killed or disappeared if they're suspected of being members. So it creates a lot of hostility. Not that necessarily drives people to support Boko Haram or other such groups, but it leaves them in a very difficult and very isolated position.
That was me talking with Elizabeth Donnelly, Africa Programme Manager at Chatham House here in London. Coming up, we head to Rome.
The Review is Monocle 24's weekly review and preview of the arts. Every Saturday, we take a relaxed look back at the books, TV shows, films, music, theatre and events that have made our week, while looking around the corner to scout out the next big thing.
It doesn't feel sappy, it doesn't feel sentimental. It does have a certain heft.
It's very Darwinian, the shows that do well run and the ones that don't close. And there have been some quite high-profile flops and some great successes as well.
For me, it's riotous, it's tasteless, but it's actually dynamic as well, it has momentum.
Join Monocle's editors as they sit down with our favourite critics, opinion makers and key industry figures for some in-depth discussion and lively debate. And we provide inspiration for the weekend from cities around the world.
It's a real divider because I know some people just love this film and other people really just hate it.
That's a review every Saturday at midday London time and across the weekend, right here on Monocle 24.
Monocle Magazine is an essential monthly briefing of affairs, business, culture, design, and travel. For £90 sterling, we'll deliver the whole year round to your home, regardless of where that might be. That's 10 issues, plus our summer and winter newspapers, Mediterraneo and Alpino, and our exclusive Monocle tote bag, designed by our creative team. Plus, all annual subscriptions allow you access to our extensive online archive. So subscribe today for a year of essential briefings. Monocle, keeping an eye on the world.
You're listening to Midori House. One of the world's more curious, opaque and arcane political rituals begins tomorrow when 115 red-hatted cardinals file into the Sistine Chapel to begin the process of choosing the next pope, an election triggered by the resignation of Benedict XVI. Current betting generally has the Italian Archbishop Angelo Scola as favourite, ahead of Ghana's Peter Turkson and Brazil's Odilo Scherer. But with 11 US electors making up the second biggest national bloc after the Italians, are Sean O'Malley of Boston and Timothy Dolan of New York in the running too? From Rome, Monocle contributor Daniela Peled, editor of the Institute of War and Peace Reporting, spoke with Andrew Muller, who asked what's occurring already in the way of visible ceremony ahead of the conclave.
Well, I think what's most visible is the media circus that has descended on Vatican City. We've got around 5,000 journalists here from all around the world, all pretty much clear in the knowledge that they are unlikely to get the exclusive on this story. So I think that's the... the speculation is enormous and rife.
This is one of those great global media news events, though, isn't it, when you have this enormous gathering of journalists surrounding an event and absolutely nobody has any idea what's actually happening?
Exactly. No one really has very much to report. I mean, this is hugely political, obviously, but unlike all other political elections, the one thing the candidates cannot be seen to do is any campaigning. Any candidate for Pope really needs to make it clear that they're not in the running and they have no interest in becoming Pope and so on and so forth. So although the conclave only really begins tomorrow, where they go into seclusion in the Sistine Chapel, everyone is being incredibly tight-lipped even now.
Aside from the thousands of journalists all furiously interviewing each other outside St. Peter's, how do Romans working in proper jobs generally behave at this point? Is this a huge deal for the rest of the city, or are people just getting on with it?
Well, to be blunt, this is a huge deal for the rest of the city in that this is usually low season for tourism, just ahead of Easter. And actually, you know, given the economy as it is at the moment, this has delivered a much-needed boost. The hotels around Vatican City are absolutely chock-a-block. And the tourists who are already coming here are rather annoyed they're not going to be able to get into the Sistine Chapel. But especially if the Pope is elected from outside Europe, I mean, the local feeling is that this really will boost tourism, and especially ahead of Easter.
Well, on that subject, what is being said about the prospect of a Ghanaian, a Brazilian, or even an American Pope?
Well, it's again, I'll join the ranks of journalists who are pontificating about the coming pontiff.
Pontificating being the operative word, of course.
Exactly. Well, it's a curious thing because the incoming Pope, reform is going to be a major priority. I mean, we find the Catholic Church in a bit of a state, really, considering there's been a huge criticism of the Curia, which is, of course, the Catholic Church central government. All kinds of scandals, corruption, not to mention the sex abuse stories. So change is going to be something important. But the Catholic Church is not an organisation that's generally keen to embrace change. So you have some potential reforming candidates, but then an electing body who are not very keen on reform. I mean, Peter Turkson, the Ghanaian candidate, is a moderate. I mean, his election would definitely signal a break with the past. But is the church really ready for an African candidate? And you have American archbishops, such as Timothy Dolan, who you mentioned, who's very charismatic and popular. But an American pope seems implausible. I mean, America is already a superpower. It doesn't seem very likely, yeah.
Well, that said, I got 18-1 on Cardinal O'Malley, and I'm quietly confident. Just finally, who's your tip?
Well, I think, to be pragmatic, that it's most likely that we're going to see a pope from outside Europe. It would make more sense to bring one in from, say, Brazil, where Catholicism is a bit more of a success story than it is in Europe, where its popularity as a religion is dwindling, shall we say. So I think I'd put my money on rather boringly, on Scherer.
Well, that was Daniela Peled, editor of the Institute of War and Peace Reporting, talking with Andrew Muller and placing their papal bets. Now, before we head over to New York, let's have a track from that city. This is Lemonade with their track Sinead.
Yeah.
Well, the track was called Sinead and the band is called Lemonade. And we're going to be talking more about fizzy drinks now because we're going to be crossing over to Aisha Spears, who's on the line, who's our New York bureau chief, and who I'm going to catch up now to talk about fizzy drinks and more in that city. Because I hear tomorrow is the big ban day on giant tubs of Coke to take away from fast food stores.
It is. So Mayor Bloomberg's very controversial ban on banning any drink that's above, fizzy drinks above 16 ounces comes into play tomorrow. So there are a lot of people who are happy and sad about it. He did a press conference this morning and saying that it's an aim to benefit the city's poor, as it's the poor people that really get hurt, is what he said in his words. A lot of people are saying that it's not really his right to determine how big a drink you can drink. It's going to be a slow process of enforcement. It's not like there are going to be cops walking around tomorrow with measuring jugs, seeing how big the Coke can is that you're buying. But we'll see that come into effect more strongly over the next couple of months, I think.
And do you know what the big chains are saying? Are the likes of McDonald's saying they're going to comply with this?
Well, they have to comply, but there's a lot of protests. I mean, even the vans that you see driving around the city in the last couple of months that deliver these drinks to all the kind of the delis and the small corner stores have these websites, these kind of petition websites saying petition against Bloomberg's soda ban. At 7-Elevens and supermarkets, it's not being enforced from tomorrow, I don't think. But all of the big companies, people have taken out ads in the New York Times. There have been local TV ads running. All the corporations who make money off these huge drinks are obviously against it, and Bloomberg saying that's an even greater reason to stop drinking them.
And so is the ban just on like Diet Coke and lemonade? Because I did hear some debate whether this would actually cover the likes of a milkshake, for example, because that's got so many calories in it. Is it just those fizzy drinks they're going after at the moment?
It's just the fizzy drinks, and it doesn't cover booze, which is what a lot of people are saying. Well, shouldn't it be covering, you know, the ability to buy huge vats of alcohol too? But it doesn't cover booze. It does just cover fizzy drinks and kind of high calorie sodas, which people so easily can drink here. It's slightly different in the US. You do see people walking around with these big gulps, which is basically the size of a bucket that you would use to clean your house, and it is full of Coke. And you can, it's so cheap to buy those kind of things. That's Bloomberg's main message. It's so cheap and it's easy, and it shouldn't be so cheap and easy to drink those drinks. If you want to drink that amount, go back and buy another cup.
And it's got nothing to do with your reason for relocating to Hong Kong, has it, the ban?
No, I'm sure. I don't think they have cups that big in Hong Kong. We'll see. Maybe I'll see something similar there.
Okay. And keeping with the mayoral theme, Christine Quinn yesterday launched her official campaign for New York mayor yesterday.
Finally, so Christine Quinn, who is the city council speaker, who we all knew was going to run for mayor, she's pretty much said that she would. And Bloomberg has kind of said that she is his favourite candidate, officially launched it over the weekend with a video, a quite sentimental video about her family's history, coming from a working class Irish family in Long Island, her father being involved in the unions, her mother dying when she was young, and talking a lot about what she'd taken from her family and what she'd done in her career and during her background, establishing facts about her political record, and had made no mention of the fact that she is gay and is the first openly gay city council speaker, and that, you know, she had a very public wedding to her partner Kim Cattullo earlier this last year. So there's been no talk of that, and people are saying that that's perhaps a mistake on her part. She's responded by saying she doubts any New Yorker doesn't think that she's gay, and she's very open about it, and she says it just didn't need to be part of her first campaign video.
So do you think she felt like she'd got that news out with her wedding and then she could move on to other topics now?
Indeed, and I think also she's got such a long record in city politics that she probably doesn't need to draw in. I think when you see campaign videos with people, you know, showing pictures of them and their families and their children and their spouses, it's because perhaps they don't have so much to run on. She's got quite a clear record that she's running on. So rather than talking about her personal life, she's deciding to talk about what she's actually done.
And actually, oddly, I've just clicked onto her campaign website, and there's a picture of her. I presume it's her parents' marriage. It's an old, faded wedding photo, but it's of a man and woman getting married. It certainly isn't of two ladies walking up the aisle. But it says, "I'm running for mayor. It's official." So you can you can join. Go to that page. Another mayor who made a little bit of news this week was Cory Booker, a gentleman who we've interviewed for Monocle magazine before. And he was at the South by Southwest festival this weekend talking about Twitter. Not that we love Twitter here, but let's indulge it for one second.
Well, this is the thing. So he really is this. He's a mayor of Newark, and he's very famous for being very pro Twitter. He really gets involved in Twitter during Hurricane Sandy. He was responding to people who needed help. He ran into burning houses. It's part of his whole kind of PR spin. And he gave this speech at South by Southwest, which is to an audience full of people who are very pro social media. Obviously, they came away loving it. But it does raise the question of how useful is it really that he is promoting this as a message for governance? He's saying that the government, that the federal government should be using social media in the way that he is, as a way to communicate with their voters more directly. But as he gets higher and higher, he's talked about running for New Jersey governor as well as for the state Senate seat. Will he really continue to talk to all of his electorate through Twitter? Surely not. And so it seems to be a little bit of a silly position to get himself in. He's had to make some apologies about inappropriate jokes he's made on Twitter. I think there's a reason that people have campaign managers and press secretaries, and it seems like he's kind of bypassing them.
Well, the other interesting thing is I see that he has 1.3 million followers, but only 300,000 people within his constituency. So it makes you think that, in fact, he's kind of got an eye on a bigger prize, and that perhaps some of this isn't really to do with looking after his own electorate.
Exactly, but as we see over the last few years, people using things like tweets in courts of law, how can he really think that he can ascend these political ladders and have such a long Twitter background where he's talking to people without any really checking what he's saying?
I've just looked at his website as well. He's got a very nice website. He's got a film as well. They've all got a film bedded in there. There's nice. He's hashtag finishing the work.
Well, that's the thing, everything's hashtagged for him. And social media is playing such a huge role in people's political presences, and there's still so much gridlock in what they're actually doing. Who knows how much help it's actually giving?
Well, I'll just let you a last second, because I'm going to have to go over to the news headlines. Paul Rand, he was talking at the weekend about his filibuster and the efforts he had to go to get through it. I see that someone sneaked him a nice flask of tea to get him all the way through that speech.
Absurd, yes. Yeah. So Rand Paul's filibuster on Wednesday against John Brennan's appointment for the CIA directorship. He wrote an op-ed on Sunday in the Washington Post, basically thanking all the senators who helped him, thanking the ones who said that what he was doing was good, who gave him an apple, who gave him thermoses of tea, which seems a little bit of an absurd way to top off quite a serious political argument.
Well, Aisha, thank you very much for joining us. Go get your final bucket and enjoy it, and get one for Barrett too. I'm sure he needs one as well. That's Aisha Spears, who's of course our New York bureau chief, but relocating to Hong Kong, where she's going to be bureau chief for the next year. I hope that wouldn't be a very long posting, wouldn't it? With 1 hour, but we're going to tell you what's happening in the next half hour here on the program. We're going to check in with our correspondent at the Herzliya conference in Israel. And we'll see what our foreign editor is up to in Sao Paulo. I hope the answer is work. That's all to come here. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Andrew, thanks very much. European Union foreign ministers arrived in Brussels today to discuss the ongoing crisis in Syria, which has killed more than 70,000 people and has displaced more than a million people. Italian judges have today ordered checks to be made on the former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi to verify his claim that health problems meant he was unable to attend his trial on charges of paying for sex with a minor. In the Netherlands, the trial of 8 suspected killers of a Dutch volunteer soccer linesman began today in a court in Lelystad. Richard Nieuwenhuizen was attacked on the 2nd of December while officiating in an under-17 match. And here, the disgraced former British Energy Minister Chris Huhne has been jailed for 8 months today for lying to police about a speeding offence in a bizarre tale of adultery and revenge that has gripped the British public. His ex-wife Vicky Price was also jailed for 8 months for her role in the deception. That's the latest news from Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Jonathan. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck. Now, from today until Thursday, bigwigs from Israel's policy, business and national security circles will congregate at the Dan Acadia Hotel in the coastal city of Herzliya for the 13th annual Herzliya Conference. The event is Israel's biggest global policy gathering, and Monocle's Jerusalem correspondent, Joseph Dana, is there on the ground. A bit earlier, Joseph caught up with Jeremy Rudin, who helps organise the event. Here's Jeremy.
Well, this is our 13th year, and basically the idea was to bring people from Israel and overseas to discuss issues, policy and strategy issues, primarily. It's held by the Institute for Policy and Strategy at IDC Herzliya, which is a private college here in Israel.
Would you say this is the most important political, economic conference of the year in Israel?
Yeah, I mean, I think this we kind of consider this like the Davos of Israel.
And so this year, the region's changing quite dramatically. What are the main issues that are kind of on the table?
Well, I think the two main things is, first of all, you know, we're heading for a new government, and we're trying to figure out, you know, where the country is going, both from the geopolitical point of view, the economic point of view, U.S.-Israeli relations. Those are the things I think that are primarily on the table now, but also dealing with the Arab Spring and all the implications going on there, how that's going to impact the region.
So are there any kind of standout speakers or anything like that, that are guests that are in attendance?
Well, I think this year we have some key speakers coming from Europe. We have the Italian foreign minister is coming, the French defense minister who's going to be here. They're going to bring the European perspective. What we're also waiting and seeing is what's going to happen with the government, because we're just saying it's a matter of another day or so that a government's going to be formed, and we are hoping that we will have someone from the new government coming to speak. Right now we have Tzipi Livni, who's supposed to be the new justice minister. But because we really don't know what's happening, we're all kind of, you know, waiting to see what it'll be.
Do you expect any surprises, any surprise announcements vis-a-vis the political environment in Israel, either the government or regionally?
You know, expecting a surprise is not something that I normally do, but I think it's definitely possible. I mean, I think if I want to be realistic, what I would like to see happen here is that if there would be a new government announced, that we would be the place that would come out and talk. So, and this would be the forum to do it, because a lot of very prominent, all the previous prime ministers have spoken here at the Herzliya conference. Almost every minister, you know, you could think of has spoken here. We've made our name becoming the forum for people to Israel to come and speak. So I hope that will continue.
Well, that was Joseph Dana there, who's at the Herzliya conference. And now, indeed, I am joined by Joseph Dana. Joseph, thank you very much for joining us. First of all, I understand that the army chief has just been speaking in the last few minutes. What are the headlines from that?
Well, this was definitely one of the most eagerly anticipated speeches of the conference. The prime minister will be speaking later in the week, but the chief of staff, you know, people are very curious as to what the army is up to and how the army is viewing the region. And so really the most interesting surprise of his comments were the fact that he openly stated that he had chosen not to talk about Iran. He talked a lot about Gaza. He talked a lot about Egypt, what's going on in Egypt, the new leadership, a little bit about Jordan, and naturally a lot about Syria. But I think a lot of people in the audience kind of wanted to hear the Israeli military chief of staff kind of make some comments vis-a-vis the Iranian situation that we keep hearing about all the time. And he deliberately chose not to, which was kind of the surprise for many people.
And Joseph, do you think that's because, you know, as we were alluding to in your discussion there with Jeremy Rudin, the organizer, that there is no government properly formed at the moment? Is that because he's waiting to see who comes into power before there is a line on that story? Or is he just kind of keeping his cards to his chest a little bit?
I think that he's definitely keeping his cards to his chest a little bit. I mean, there are a number of panels, I mean, a disproportionate number of panels dealing with the Iranian situation. What's Israel thinking? What does the region look like vis-a-vis an Israeli attack in Iran or something along those lines? And so I think the chief of staff wanted to, he kind of seemed as though he was speaking in a very fatherly way, in a sort of manner, saying, you know, the army is very strong. We understand that the region is transforming around us, but rest assured, you know, the Israeli state will rise to any kind of challenge. And so I think he wanted to not necessarily raise any sort of alarm bells. You know, he didn't want to have any sort of headline coming out of the Herzliya conference that the Israelis are planning an immediate attack. I guess they leave that more to Netanyahu and more of the political leadership.
Jonas, we have a very rough line to you, and I apologize to listeners for that. But just tell me, the conference itself, is it mainly looking at defense issues? I did look at their program today, and I saw that it was also covering everything, oddly, from, you know, civic transport in the city, all sorts of challenges that face the state of Israel. And is it really just Israelis speaking in this conference, or do you have visiting people from around the region and Europe coming to talk as well?
Well, you have a lot of European influence, a lot of American influence, of course. And like you said, it's a very broad conference. I mean, this is the 13th year that it's been held. And so we see the Herzliya conference trying to be more like Davos, like the press spokesman mentioned, and trying to incorporate, you know, issues of urbanism, a lot of discussion about business. Israel's natural gas, which is a very, very hot topic in the press here, is going to be treated in a number of panels. And so, you know, they're really making a very, very strong effort to put forward an image of a very rich debate happening in Israeli society that is inclusive of, you know, European voices, American voices, and even Asian voices. We have a number of Chinese representatives and business people at the conference. And so there's a very interesting dynamic of mingling and whatnot happening in Herzliya this afternoon.
Now, during the opening speech for the conference, Uri Rachman was talking about the fact that there needs to be freedom for the Palestinians. Is this really a topic that's on the agenda for most Israeli politicians at the moment? What we've heard from you and other people over the past year is that this has been so sidelined that people just don't even want to think about it, or they want to kind of say the issue's dead and we're not giving up any territory and we can do what we like. Is that really coming back to the fore, do you think?
Well, your point is very good. I mean, it has been sidelined in terms of the Israeli internal debate. But what's so interesting about Herzliya this year, this conference this year, is that President Obama is making his first official visit next week. And we see the conference as a kind of platform for what the Israelis intend to kind of put forward vis-a-vis what Obama is going to be doing on the ground with Netanyahu and with Abbas in Ramallah. And so this issue, this inclusion that freedom for the Palestinians is a necessary kind of component of the Israeli future, as it were, was a very interesting admission, which I think many people understood as a clear kind of signal to the American leadership that that Israel does understand the dynamics of the situation and does understand the importance of the Palestinian issue for, you know, future peace negotiations and whatnot.
One of the other things I thought was surprising to have come up already as a talking point was the fact that Israel needs to introduce civil partnerships or recognize them anyway. And that seemed to be, is that because, you know, Israel wants to make sure that it's, you know, it's kept together with, you know, Europe and America, it's seen as culturally part of that union? Or does it have a real belief in, you know, that it has to kind of change these things for its internal audience as well?
I think that both of those issues apply to that debate. I mean, right now, the Israeli election that we're kind of coming out of and the coalition is being formed, it was very much a referendum on domestic politics. And so domestic issues about the secular character of the state versus the religious character of the state are very much on Israeli minds. That's what people are talking about in places like Tel Aviv and Haifa and Jerusalem. And so the issue of civil marriage, also the issue of writing a constitution, you know, Israel is a state that does not have a constitution, was debated quite seriously today in the Herzliya conference. And it does demonstrate Israel does, you know, kind of take seriously its position vis-a-vis the West. It wants to be and includes itself in the Western kind of understanding of how countries operate. And so we're seeing very much increased rhetoric about civil marriage and issues, you know, kind of debating the secular versus the religious character of the country.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. That's Joseph Dana, who's our correspondent in Jerusalem and who is telling us about that conference. It's covering literally everything from civil partnerships to potential wars in the region. Now, we're going to cross straight over to Florence because there's a very different conference going on there. There's the Florence Food Fair. It's or Petit Taste, as it's known. In fact, it's just wrapping up. And we have our man there, Ivan Cavallo, who now joins us on the line to tell us all about that event. Ivan, thank you for coming on. You've certainly got a tough gig, hey? Going to an Italian food festival. Why is this festival held?
Hey, good evening, Andrew. It was started by Davide Paolini, a journalist and food fan. And Petit Taste is run by the same group that runs the Petit Uomo fashion shows and fragrance fairs. And they've put together lots of artisanal producers. There's 300 almost at this fair. And it allows not just Italian gourmet shops, but people from abroad to come and taste some of the great wealth of Italian food products.
And now tell me, you know, around the world, we're seeing most countries struggling with austerity, and certainly Italy is too. Falling incomes, households feeling a bit pinched. Is there still an expanding market for artisanal food, for this, you know, to be honest, more expensive food than you'd find in a supermarket? Has Italy remained robust in its defence of good eating?
Definitely. Now, this is a an island of say happiness in an economy that's not doing very well. And you know, exports, it's doing extremely well in a lot of emerging markets. And say in the U.S., I mean, the food and wine exports, food alone is outdoing the Italian auto industry, which has been in decline for many years now. And emerging markets, it was quite interesting to see, not just, of course, from Asia, but to see buyers representing lots of restaurants and food shops in places like in the Baltic states, for example. It was interesting to see these buyers going around and tasting, whether it was salami or checking out, talking with pasta producers and chocolate makers as well.
And are there kind of sectors that you're seeing particularly expand at Pitti Taste? You know, is the wine industry kind of pushing forward as it tries to find new markets? Are you finding that actually mozzarella is a kind of a big growth? Because I see all these mozzarella bars now opening around the world with the like of a Bica, and you go to even Japan and you see fresh mozzarella flown in there. What's the kind of the areas of the kind of agri industry on this smaller scale that are doing well?
I think one thing, Prosecco, if you look at wine, and Vinitaly, the big wine fair is coming up in Verona at the beginning of April, but you've seen sparkling wine, Italian sparkling wine, do very well abroad. In the U.S. it's growing. Italy is the biggest exporter of wine to the U.S. now, because it's also less expensive on average than, say, the French Champagne. They also have Italians make a Franciacorta, which is a region just near Milan, which is a same kind of method of Champagne. That's something that people are also now trying to taste and to learn about. With pasta, it's actually, I was quite surprised to see a new company this year, Pasta Mancini. They grow the wheat in the field, and right there they have the pasta factory, a gentleman who used to work for Brilla, working with local varieties of wheat, because sometimes the pasta comes, the wheat comes from different areas, and then they make it somewhere else. And he's doing this sort of very sort of slow food, if you want to say, style of making pasta, letting it air dry for several days using these traditional bronze dyes, and then a wonderful packaging so that on the shelf it looks like something you'd want to give for a gift almost.
Now, yeah, the Easley brand, which is a supermarket chain based on the, well, supermarket's a bit unfair, a food shop chain based on the slow food movement. I see that they, off the back of this, they're expanding even more around the world.
Yeah, Italy, they work with the slow food movement to help, who are consultants, to help find quality producers. And they've expanded in these very large stores. New York is one that's very well known. They have them in Italy as well. And they're looking at expansion, Chicago, Sao Paulo, Istanbul, to bring the public into contact with a lot of these producers. Some of them sort of, let's say, a little bit larger, medium, say, size, that make lots of pasta, to smaller artisanal makers of whether it's jams, preserves, coffee, or chocolate, for example.
And tell me, was there one standout product that you saw at the fair you think that we should potentially be importing?
Well, there's one that I believe you've tried. It's Guido Gobino. He's a chocolate maker from Turin, who makes wonderful chocolates with hazelnuts, which is something that Turin is known for. He makes a cremino with this sea salt, and also extra virgin olive oil, which is a very interesting combination in the mouth. Another, I would say, is Castelmagno, a very old history, a cheese that's made in the Piedmont Alps, 800-year history. Gourmands are going crazy for it. It's had a bit of, a revival, and something that people are looking for now in high-end restaurants. It has its own Presidio slow food, so it's following traditional methods in terms of how they're making the cheese and how they work with the cows in the pasture. So Castelmagno is something, if you want to talk with your friends about who's more the gourmand, raise that in conversation, and you'll be, people will be, that's interesting.
I'll raise a glass of Prosecco to you later. Thank you very much, Ivan Carvalho. That's Ivan, who's our correspondent in Milan. And next, we're going to be heading over to Brazil.
Berlin has long been a magnet for artists. As the city continues to evolve, Monocle Films explores how galleries and artists are being influenced by Berlin's complex presence.
One of the reasons that I'm in Berlin, and which is intriguing for me, is that the history is here. It's not necessarily in these bricks and mortar. It's somehow in this atmosphere. One of the great things with Berlin is it takes time to do things. Berlin is slow enough for art to happen.
Art in Berlin, a film about ghosts of the past with a view to the future, on monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. It's 15:49 currently in Sao Paulo, and that's where we're heading now, because all this week, Monocle's foreign editor Steve Bloomfield is in Brazil, taking part in a conference on soft power. In recent years, Brazil has seen its soft power stock rise thanks to energetic diplomacy from a revitalised foreign ministry, a booming economy, and successful bids for both the Football World Cup and the Summer Olympic Games. With that World Cup just 15 months away, Brazil is beginning to think about the image it wants to create over the next 3 years of sporting attention. Steve arrived in Sao Paulo this morning, but anyway, we're going to quiz him already about everything he knows about Brazil, and he's joining me on the line now. Steve, thanks very much for joining us. So tell us, why are you there?
We're here to take part in this soft power conference, which, as many people know, is something very close to our hearts at Monocle. Soft power is essentially all the things that hard power is not. So it's your culture, it's your sport, it's your food, it's your iconic figures. And Brazil has that in abundance. The big issue, though, is how they use that, particularly over the next 3 years, as you say, when the eyes of the world will be on them.
And who will be attending this conference?
There's various people from Brazilian Culture Ministry, from the Foreign Ministry, various ambassadors who are in Brasilia who are coming down, and also other countries as well. So Mexico, Chile, Turkey are all sending representatives here. And then there's also quite a strong British contingent. So it's looking at, it's organised by a group called Wilton Park, which is connected to the Foreign and Commonwealth Office in the UK. So it's looking as well at sort of how Britain uses soft power, which of course, as any readers of the most recent soft power survey in Monocle will know, does soft power rather well. They came top in our most recent survey.
Now, first impressions do count, and tell me what yours have been. You know, that actually, so for some people, when you arrive at, you know, the Brazilian airports, they've needed a bit of updating. I think that's still a process that's being carried out at the moment. The journey from city to airport and airport to city can be a bit tough. Sao Paulo strikes you as huge when you get there. What have been your immediate impressions of the city and how it works?
Yeah, well, I think you're right there. Sao Paulo doesn't help itself with its initial welcome. There were four flights that came in all at the same time around 6 o'clock this morning, and it seemed to somewhat overwhelm the customs staff. So it took about an hour and a half to get through customs. Then the traffic in Sao Paulo was bumper to bumper, so it's 2.5 hours to the hotel. And now that can sound like whinging, but it's also, if you've been on a long sort of 11-hour flight, for it to then be another 4 hours before you get to hotel, that does then make you think, this place is it really sort of, you got it all together? However, once we're here and we're fine and we're sorted, then that changes. And, I've been wandering about all day, had some good food, walked through a couple of parks, headed to a museum, and you start to see why people get so excited about this city.
And just tell me, finally, Steve, the World Cup is only, 15 months away. Will you be able to check up on any of the preparations for that? And is there any sense already from the people you've been speaking to of excitement about these impending sports events?
There is a lot of excitement, yes. And I think it's still in that stage where people are a little bit nervous. Is everything going to be sorted out in time? There are going to be changes to the airports. and there are new stadiums being built, or certainly old ones being reconstructed. There are a lot of things that perhaps aren't quite as in place as they perhaps should be, but there's still excitement about it. And I'm certainly hoping as well to get a flavour of that excitement on Thursday when Corinthians, one of the local sides in Sao Paulo, are playing a Copa Libertadores match, which is their equivalent of the Champions League, the South American Champions League. So I'll be, in the interest of research, obviously, going along to that to see whether Brazilian football is ready for the World Cup.
Great, Steve. Well, I know that we're going to be checking with you in with you over the week. So that's Steve Bloomfield, who's in Sao Paulo for Monocle, and he's attending that Soft Power conference. And now it's time for our daily monologue. And today we turn to Monocle's Tokyo Bureau Chief, Fiona Wilson, who looks at Japan's recovery after the earthquake that hit the country 2 years ago.
Residents of Tokyo might have been excused for having other things on their mind than the impending anniversary of the March 11th earthquake yesterday. The city was enjoying record March temperatures when a yellow sandstorm blew in from China, obscuring the sun and filling the sky with an eerie haze, leaving people to run for cover, or at least the nearest convenience store to get their hands on a face mask. It didn't stop thousands of people turning out on the streets of Tokyo to demonstrate against nuclear power and the pro-nuclear leaning of the new government. Today the sun has been shining again, and thoughts are on events of 2 years ago today, when a magnitude 9 earthquake struck Tohoku on Japan's northeast coast. It triggered a devastating tsunami, a nuclear catastrophe, as the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant was inundated and suffered a triple meltdown. That day, when over 18,000 people died or disappeared, is now marked by a moment's silence at 2:46 p.m., and memorial events in the northeast and in Tokyo, with the Emperor and Prime Minister Shinzo Abe in attendance. So where is Japan now, 2 years on from what the World Bank predicted would be the costliest natural disaster in history? Both the same, but different. The country has bounced back with characteristic resilience, and in many ways, it's business as usual. Tokyo is back to its former brilliance, somewhat more sensitive to the need to save energy, but otherwise brimming with energy and construction. In the northeast, though, the picture is somewhat different. Over 300,000 people are still in temporary housing, frustrated by the slow pace of rebuilding, and in the areas around Fukushima, decontamination. Recent photographs of the Fukushima nuclear plant have revealed that it is still piled with debris and tangled metal. Thousands of people are working on its recovery, but it will take decades to decommission the reactors. Footage from the shattered coast shows that the clean-up operation has been impeccable, the destroyed towns and villages swept and scoured, and yet the displaced communities remain in limbo, as final decisions about whether they will ever be rebuilt are still to be made, and residents struggle to recover their livelihoods. Those tense months after the earthquake, when Tokyo was being rattled by aftershocks, are now a distant memory. But anxiety about Japan's energy future remains. Only two of the country's 50 reactors are in operation. The rest lie idle, while safety standards are put in place that may well mean that some never reopen. The profound political change that people anticipated hasn't happened. Any hope of a new consensus politics evaporated in short order as political sniping recommenced and prime ministers came and went. Exasperation with the government and a yearning for stability was reflected in the election last December of the LDP, the Conservative Liberal Democratic Party that had until 2009 ruled Japan almost without break since the war. Worries about the economy apparently trumped a desire for a nuclear-free Japan, as voters half-heartedly elected the party whose cozy relationship with the power companies had been partially responsible for the mismanagement that was exposed by the tsunami. So, 2 years after Japan's greatest post-war crisis, there has been no revolution. We find ourselves back with the LDP and back with Shinzo Abe, the ultra-conservative politician who had already served a brief stint as Prime Minister 6 years ago. So far, Abe has defied the electorate's low expectations by talking tough on the economy and managing not to antagonise Japan's neighbours, and his ratings have risen to an unusually high 70%. The new government has brought with it a new energy to the reconstruction process. Takumi Nemoto, the reconstruction minister and a Fukushima native, has vowed to make housing a priority, announcing an increased budget to speed up the rebuilding of schools, homes and businesses. In a video posted on YouTube this morning, the Prime Minister, Shinzo Abe, offered viewers a poetic image, saying that unless spring comes to Tohoku, real spring cannot come to Japan. For Monocle in Tokyo, I'm Fiona Wilson.
Well, it's been such a packed show today. All I have time to say, thank you to all the team for pulling this together. I'll be back at the same time tomorrow. That's with Midori House. And the Culture Show is next with Mr. Robert Bowne. It's time to say goodbye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.